Hi, I'm Una Chaplin, and I'm the host of a new podcast called Hollywood Exiles. It tells the story of how my grandfather, Charlie Chaplin, and many others were caught up in a campaign to root out communism in Hollywood. It's a story of glamour and scandal and political intrigue and a battle for the soul of a nation. Hollywood Exiles from CBC Podcasts and the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hey, I'm Talia Schlanger, sitting in for Tom Power. Welcome to Q. I think it's safe to say I'm not alone in this. A lot of us have books that sit on our shelves for years, and we stare at them, we look at the spines, we look at the covers, before we finally actually get around to reading them. Maybe we're waiting for a rainy day or for the right mood to strike. Don Landis is a really accomplished and respected American singer-songwriter, kind of in the folk Americana world. And one day, when she opened a book that she had been carrying with her for years, something incredible happened. Don suddenly became connected to a group of women who offered her a reminder of their shared history. The book we're talking about is called The Liberated Women's Songbook. It was first published in 1971 at the height of the Women's Liberation Movement. It features 77 songs that take readers of the book through the history of women's activism in music. And the women behind these songs are housewives, some of them are labor organizers and suffragettes. They're advocating for better in their homes and in their workplaces, for themselves and for each other and for their children. And the book, reading this book, led Dawn down a bit of a rabbit hole. When she came out on the other side, she had recorded a selection of those songs, reimagining 11 tracks from the book for today's audiences, like this one, which is originally from 1882. It's called Keep Woman in Her Sphere.
I have a neighbor, one of those not very hard to find. Who sees the world in black and white won't ever change their mind. I asked him about women's rights, his answer was severe. My mind on that is all made up, dear. Keep warm.
Don Landis, that's from her new album. It's called The Liberated Woman's Songbook, just like the book that inspired her to make the album. And it all serves as a reminder of the power of music throughout time. I spoke to Don Landis from her home in North Carolina. Hey, Don, welcome to Q.
Thanks for having me, Talia.
Absolutely. So this album, The Liberated Woman's Songbook, features 11 songs originally from 1830 to 1970, reimagined by you. And those songs are taken from a book of the same title from 1971 that you found at a used bookshop. What made you want to take that book home in the first place?
The cover. I'm not going to lie. The cover of this book is so provocative. The font is so cool. It's just screams 70s. And there's a woman on the cover pointing, and she's looking very adamant. She's got a really cool leather jacket on and some sunglasses. I don't know. It's, and there's a sort of cross between a woman and a man sort of symbol. And it also is also a banjo. So I don't know. I just found it very interesting. And then the look of it all. And then inside there are these really cool photographs and bits of history about each song. And I was very attracted to the aesthetic of the whole thing.
Yeah. And the book description, which reads 77 singable folk songs about women and their battles with husbands, lovers, the devil, the system, and themselves. I mean, how do you not pick that up?
I know. It's so good.
So just get us up to speed a little bit with the historical context of the book. What was going on in the women's liberation movement at the time the book was published back in 71?
Yeah. So I did a lot of historical digging for this project. Myself, I never took a women and gender studies in college, for example. So I feel like I really got a full education about this. So I'm no expert. But what I can tell you that I've learned in the past 2 years is really the women's liberation movement, at least in the United States, really kicked off in 1968 at the Miss America protest in Atlantic City. That was one of the big first moments. And so by that point, you know, you had your stalwarts of the movement, Gloria Steinem and Florence Kennedy, and Betty Friedan, they were all publishing books. And, you know, Gloria Steinem had started Ms. Magazine. So there were avenues for women's voices. But yeah, everything just really started to take shape. I would say it was in full swing, definitely, by 71. So, I mean, you know how book publishing works. I'm sure he had to have these all compiled. The man who put this all together was a folklorist and a guitarist and just sort of a song collector named Jerry Silverman. So, you know, he probably had the song stop in 1970. So, but there were so many more made after that, you know, that'll be another record. But
exactly. And then, of course, a couple of years after the book came out, Roe versus Wade was passed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And in the introduction to, I was really struck by the introduction to the songbook, just speaking about, you know, how far women have come, but they still are lacking in all these rights. And the fact that it was published, you know, 3 years prior to women being able to have their own credit card in their name in the United States, you know, so pretty wild, the rights that we've accrued and over the years. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And speaking of the years, you had the book for years, but I understand that it wasn't really until 2022 when Roe v. Wade was overturned that you really dove into it. So what did it give you to discover the songs in the book during that time?
Yeah, you know, I had carried around, I found this in a used bookstore and I had carried around with me. I lived in New York for a long time and it was in my rehearsal space in Brooklyn. I remember seeing it there. And then I moved to Nashville and then I moved to North Carolina and it came with me. You know, every time you move, you kind of reassess all of your stuff.
Yeah.
So I saw it in all of those moments, but I never really felt like I needed it. You know, it was sort of like a curiosity, like this really cool, sort of like an art coffee table book. But, you know, when the Dobbs decision that leaked in the United States, the Supreme Court decision to retract women's right to reproductive freedom, it was unsettling to me. And I was looking for something to hold on to, something to make me feel better. And this book just called out to me. And so I started learning, you know, every day I would sit down in the morning and learn a song. And lyrically, that spoke to me. I'd say, oh, this one's interesting. I wonder what this person was singing about. And so I made a bunch of demos, maybe like 25 demos or something of these songs. And I wasn't sure what I was going to do with it. And then I sent them to my old friend and collaborator, Josh Kaufman, who's a wonderful musician and songwriter in upstate New York. And we just started collaborating remotely, which is new for me. I hadn't really done much of that. So, but we had played music together for many years. And, we toured together in a band and know each other really well. So that was very easy, but he was very helpful in, you know, narrowing down the songs and figuring out how we were going to modernize these songs for audiences today.
I understand you updated some of the language too. Are there any examples of something that you had to really change to make a song relevant for now?
That's a great question. Yeah. So, I mean, some of these are very old.
Yeah.
You know, like the 1830 is the oldest one. And the language was a little bit different then. But there's one song I'm thinking of. Well, the hardest one for me was a song called 100 Years in 100 Years. And it was written in 1852 by a playwright and an activist named Fanny Gage. And the chorus, the crux of the song was 100 years hence. And I don't feel comfortable with the word hence. I don't use the word hence. I don't know anyone. I don't think the word hence has ever been said to me in my lifetime. So I thought, I can't sing a song repeatedly singing hence. No one's going to understand what I'm talking about. And I don't want them to, I don't want it to take them out of the story and out of the song. So I had to completely restructure the rhyme scheme for that one because everything rhymed with hence, you know? So that one was like a complete unearthing of that song.
In 100 years, what a change will be made in politics, morals, religion, and trade, in leaders who teeter and tiptoe the line. Things will improve in 100 years' time.
There's one about, it's called Keep Woman in Her Sphere. And there was a line, I'm trying to think, it was like, he forth the grog shop come. Which I don't know if you know what that means, but I
understood you completely. Yeah, yeah.
In modern speak, it's he came back from the bar, you know, so it's just little things like that. Like, I want people to know, just tell it to me straight. What's happening in this situation?
So we've got some language updates. I wanted to start with the first song from the record to ask you about specifically, Hard is the Fortune of All Womankind, originally from 1830. Can you tell me a little bit about that song?
Yes, I love this song. It was really hard to date some of these songs. You know, a lot of times when you see a traditional song written down, it usually just has the song title and then in parentheses, traditional, because it's really hard to tell when these first appeared. I said 1830 because that was the earliest it was documented by Cecil B. Sharp. But it turns out that the first line, that what I'll call the chorus of the song, because musically it's the same the whole way through, was actually in a play in the 1700s, in a British play called The Lady's Case. But anyway, the song back then took a completely different turn. And so the one I'm singing, I'm crediting to 1830. But yeah, that one has been sung over the years. I did a lot of research looking at zines and news clips from the women's liberation movement in the 60s and 70s. And that song appeared a lot. People were singing it at rallies and on college campuses. Peggy Seeger released a recording of it in 1954, and Joan Baez in the early 60s under an alternate title called The Wagoner's Lad.
Oh, hard is the fortune of all womankind. She's always controlled, she's always confined. Controlled by her parents until she's a wife.
But yeah, it's really powerful song. I mean, the verse, the hard is the fortune of all womankind. She's always controlled. She's always confined. I don't know. It's that's from the 1700s, that one.
What did it feel like to just sing those words?
It felt good. I mean, I'm not an actor, but I can only imagine like when you perform Shakespeare, there's something so powerful about it because it has withstood the test of time. And for me, these songs did that. Hmm. And maybe they're not household names. You know, a lot of these songs I had never even heard of before. But the ideas are essential. The ideas connect to the ideas. And so that felt really powerful to me, to be singing something that was created and articulated so long ago and still so relevant now.
Oh, hard is the fortune of all womankind. She's always controlled, always confined. Controlled by her parents until she's a wife, a slave to her husband the rest of her life. Oh, I am a poor girl, my fortune is sad. I've always been courted by the wagoner's lad. He courted me daily by night and by day, and now he is loading and going away.
You're singing songs from women that come from such a range of backgrounds. There are housewives and labor organizers and suffragettes and writers. Is there a woman that you met through doing this work that you really connected with or that you feel a special connection to?
Ooh, yes. I've been really fortunate. Other than the album, I've performed this a couple times, which is unusual for me. I don't usually perform a work before the recordings are released, but there's been such momentum for this project, which it really is exciting for me, that I've gotten to do this as sort of a musical review where I invite other women singers to join me on stage. And the first time we performed this, I invited Alice Gerard to kind of close out the evening. And if you're not familiar with her, she's turning 90 this year, and she's sort of a bluegrass pioneer. Her and Hazel Dickens made a lot of great music early on and were some of the first women fronted bluegrass bands, you know, working.
You say they are blues, these old miners. You say they are blues, these old miners blue. Now I must have sharpened these picks that I use.
And they had a lot of labor organizer songs, coal miner songs, women empowerment songs, and she was making music in the 1970s. So it was really exciting to speak with her about her life at that point and what the music meant to her, and then to hear some of the songs she was writing at that time. and sing them with her on stage, which was really exciting. And to get to know her, you know, she's fantastic. And she just released an album this year, I think. She's incredible.
In her 90s.
Yeah.
That's incredible. That is really inspiring. And I bet it meant a lot to her to get to connect with you and see, you know, that the torch is in very good hands.
She was very supportive of this. And that really gave me a lot of confidence, really.
I'm Talia Schlanger, sitting in for Tom Power here on Q. Coming up, more of my conversation with Don Landis.
Think of your favorite one-hit wonder.
Or that overpriced toy your parents would never let you have.
Or that TV show that no one else remembers because it was canceled way too soon. Now what if we could fix it? I'm Francesca Ramsey.
And I'm DeLon Grant. And after 20 years of friendship, we are now hosting a new nostalgia podcast called Let Me Fix It.
Each episode, we'll dig into our favorite celebrities, shows, and brands of yesteryear, and then imagine what it would take to repackage them for relevance today.
Think of our show as an intervention, but with way less stakes.
So subscribe to Let Me Fix It wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
I also wanted to ask you about the song, Which Side Are You On?, which was written during the Harlan County coal miner strike in 1931. And I understand that your version combines two different songs by two different women. Could you tell me a bit about that?
Yeah, well, I'm originally from Kentucky, so any Kentucky songs I always feel a special kinship with. So yeah, both of these songs were written in the early 1930s when there were these big coal mining strikes going on in Harlan County, and women weren't allowed to work in coal mines. So both of the women that wrote these two songs were affected by the mines. Their husbands and their brothers and their fathers worked in the mines, and their families and their incomes and their housing, everything, their whole lives, their healthcare, everything was affected by these mines. Mm-hmm. But the two women who were writing at that time that are in the song, it's sort of a mashup of Florence Reese's Which Side Are You On? And Aunt Molly Jackson's I Am a Union Woman. And so both of them would sing a cappella. They would just get up in front of a crowd to rally support for the union and just sing. And a lot of these songs actually were sung a cappella, because a lot of these songs were not written by quote unquote musicians. You know, they were written by regular people who had something to say. And so they would just write what they had to say to a melody of the time, you know? So I could not find any evidence that Florence Reese and Aunt Molly Jackson ever actually met each other, which blew my mind. Hmm. Like, how did they both write a very similar song to a very similar melody at the same time and live pretty near each other, but never meet or never cross paths? I don't understand how that's possible. So what we made them meet in the song, and I'm singing the part of Florence Reese, and Kanine Pipkin from The Lone Bellow is singing beautifully the Aunt Molly Jackson part.
Which side are you on? Which side are you on? I was raised in old Kentucky,
Some of the songs were written to hymns or to children's songs, which I think is really fascinating. What did you learn about why women were writing protest songs to the tune of kids' songs?
Well, I think that, yeah, like what I said before about how a lot of people weren't maybe musically, they didn't have the training or even the instrument to write something on. But also when you're in a protest situation, you have to communicate an idea very quickly to a lot of people. And so the best way to do that is via music that's already known. So a lot of these were hymns, because a lot of people were going to church and everybody knows children's songs, you know, and that's still really true today. So maybe less of the hymns today, but you know, it's an easy communicator, because you can't count on multi-generations of people knowing a melody to something.
There was a young woman who swallowed a lie. We all know why she swallowed that lie. Perhaps she'll die.
Do you sing these songs to your kids? Do you sing any of them to your kids?
Well, my daughter is now 6 and a half, and she likes all of the songs. She likes hearing me sing them with other people too, because it's really fun to sing these songs with other women. Mm. Especially when you get to sing it with a six-year-old in the mix. It's really fun.
Yeah. And it says
liberation now.
it's powerful too. So, I mean, obviously we're listening to these songs in such a different historic context than they were written. Like you said, this book that the songs are largely drawn from came out a few years before women could get their own credit cards, right? So we can do that now. We have credit cards. We can vote. It's a different context. So if somebody's listening right now and thinking like, is the fortune of all womankind that hard right now? Like, Dawn, do you need to be singing these songs? Why do we still need these songs?
Well, I don't know. I just look at women's rights worldwide. And I remember, you know, several years ago, you know, reading stories about women being taken out of university, stories of women's reproductive rights, freedoms being revoked. It's scary. It's a scary time. And it's anti-progress, right? It's a regression. And I'm pro progress, I guess. I want to see everything move forward and yeah, the betterment of people's lives, as you said before. It's just, that's what I'm hoping for.
You're also putting out the record in a US presidential election year at a time when reproductive rights in the States are on a lot of people's minds. What do you hope that people take from listening to these songs in 2024?
Well, I've structured the album chronologically. And for me, that really helps to tell me a story. When I hear the songs in order, like you hear an evolution of language and of scope, you know, because they hadn't hardly any rights long ago, you know, and things have gotten better. And so that in and of itself is comforting to see the progression of women's rights, women's struggles. That is helpful for me. That makes me feel better, but also just the stridency of it all. You know, I love, that's another thing, you know, like the cover of the songbook, you know, the suffragettes were very sort of austere and, you know, over time women just got more emboldened and I'm very attracted to that. And I want to harness that boldness and give it to people and go forth and be bold.
Love it. Dawn, congrats on this album. It's really beautiful and it is bold. It's beautiful. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
I have a neighbor, one of those not very hard to find, who sees the world in black and white, won't ever change their mind. I asked him about women's rights, his answer was severe. My mind on that is all made up, dear. Keep woman in her sphere.
That's Dawn Landis, American singer-songwriter, talking about her new album, The Liberated Woman's Songbook. It is worth your ears, start to finish, to hear her treatments of these songs and to hear that traced history that you heard Dawn talking about there. That's it for this episode of the Q Podcast, but you can find another one in your feed right now. It's my chat with Rudy Mancuso, an artist who has kind of pulled off an amazing feat. Okay, he has co-written, directed, composed, starred in his very first feature film, and it is a representation, an imagination, if you will, of what it's like for him to live with synesthesia. That means something different for everybody, but essentially, if you have it, it means that your senses get blended together. And for Rudy, that means everyday sounds turn into music in his mind. He's represented that so beautifully in his film that is a musical, not a musical, rom-com, not a rom-com. You can find our chat in your feed right now. I'm Talia Schlanger, sitting in for Tom Power. I'll see you next time.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.